Greets, I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits. Take a look and...
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, John Russell tells us what officials in many U.S. cities are proposing to help struggling downtown business areas. Brian Lynn presents this week's Science Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first,
officials in many American cities say they want companies to turn empty office buildings into housing. These housing plans, known as office-to-housing conversions, can help downtown business areas that became empty as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Some policymakers consider conversions a way to increase the supply of less costly or affordable housing. Critics doubt the positive effects of these changes. In the fall of 2022, the Congressional Research Services, or CRS, released a report. The report noted that housing costs in the United States have become a big issue. That is because housing prices are high, housing supplies are limited, and mortgage interest rates are rising. The report noted that there have been some increases in new house building activities, but problems related to rising building costs and the availability of labor and materials remain. At the same time, vacancy rates at downtown office buildings continue to rise. Vacancy rates show how much unused office space there is. The real estate business CBRE said the vacancy rate was 12.2% in the last 3 months of 2019. The number increased to 17.8% in the first 3 months of 2023. Some places with the lowest use of office space include San Francisco, with a vacancy rate of 29.4%, Houston at 23.6%, Philadelphia at 21.7%, and Washington, D.C. at 20.3%. As a result of limited housing supply and the increasing number of empty office buildings, a number of cities are offering lower taxes for building developers. These tax breaks aim to increase office-to-housing conversions. One requirement is that a set percentage of apartments are offered at below-market prices. In January, Pittsburgh announced it was accepting ideas to produce more affordable housing through the conversion of underutilized office space. Underutilized means that the space is not being used. In October, Boston released a plan aimed at improving downtown. The plan included a push for more housing, some of which would come from office conversions. And Seattle in Washington State launched a competition in April for downtown building owners and design companies to come up with conversion ideas. In Washington, D.C., Mayor Muriel Bowser wants office-to-housing conversions to help repopulate the downtown area. Her plan, announced earlier this year, seeks to add 15,000 new residents downtown, adding to the approximately 25,000 who already live there. "We're not going to have as many workers downtown as we had before the pandemic, Bowser said earlier this year. Our job is to make sure that we are getting more people downtown. But critics have doubts about the conversion push. Housing advocates worry that the affordable housing requirements could be reduced or pushed aside. Even supporters of the conversions say that giving tax breaks to big developers is not the best tool to reach their goals. Developers who feel it's going to benefit their bottom line will do it without an incentive, said Erica Williams, director of the DC Fiscal Policy Institute. This is a very costly proposal for an unproven program. And, as increasing numbers of employers turn to hybrid work, some question whether people will want to move to downtown areas if they are not required to work in an office every day. Last January, Pittsburgh Mayor Ed Gainey said at the United States Conference of Mayors meetings in Washington, "You have to make downtown a neighborhood, somewhere that's living and playful and active." I'm John Russell.
Last week's flight test of SpaceX's Starship spacecraft caused major damage to the launch structure in the state of Texas. The day after the test, SpaceX chief Elon Musk said on Twitter the damage to the launch area was greater than expected. Musk explained that the company had started work 3 months before on a large water-cooled steel plate to be placed underneath the concrete launch pad. The structure is meant to protect the concrete pad, the rocket's support structure, from being damaged from the heat and force of the rocket's engines. But Musk added that the steel plate would not have been ready before the launch date on April 20th. He said SpaceX wrongly thought the concrete launch pad would survive the liftoff because it had survived an earlier test. He suggested that the steel plate could be ready for a new launch attempt in 1 to 2 months. But it is currently not clear when the next Starship test will be approved. The Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, has said it will have to carry out an investigation of the launch site damage before it can approve a new test. Pictures published on social media have shown large pieces of concrete being pushed deeply into the ground. Video of the launch showed pieces of debris being thrown up to 420 meters away. The launch also reportedly created several large craters around the area. The test involved SpaceX's Super Heavy rocket, which carries the Starship capsule on top. The capsule is designed to carry astronauts and supplies to the moon and possibly to Mars. The Super Heavy rocket is powered by 33 engines and is by far more powerful than any rockets built by the American space agency, NASA. The two-part rocket ship successfully launched from the SpaceX Launch Center called Starbase in Boca Chica, Texas, but it exploded minutes later and crashed into the sea. SpaceX had hoped that after separating, the spacecraft would continue flying and attempt to circle the world before crashing into the Pacific Ocean near Hawaii. But even with the explosion, the company has described the flight test as a success because the huge rocket was able to get off the ground. Other launch sites in the United States use long diverters in the ground to guide fire away from the rockets. The diverters are designed to limit damage from launches. The launch area that SpaceX uses at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida has diverters. Without diverters, debris thrown into the air during liftoff could strike the rocket itself and nearby areas, engineers say. Phil Metzger is a planetary scientist at the University of Central Florida who has studied the effects of rocket launches and landings. He said on Twitter, "Launch and landing pads are touchy. Any little thing that goes wrong can cause a zipper effect that creates a giant problem." Metzger said such difficulties can result because the energy used to push the rocket into space needs to be absorbed on the ground. Observers say the incident demonstrates a certain rocket development culture at SpaceX. That culture favors more tests and failures of new vehicles to provide data to improve future designs. Tom Morata advises other space companies on launch rules. He told Reuters news agency the FAA oversees launch safety and carries out technical investigations into rocket failures. He said the agency will need to approve changes to Starship's launch area before any new launch attempts. Morata added that the bigger challenge for SpaceX will be getting the FAA to examine its steel plate in order to approve another launch test in the coming months. The FAA has confirmed that no injuries resulted from the launch test, the French news agency AFP reported, but it has also said that no new tests will be approved if there is a threat to public safety. Olivier Devecq is a professor of astronautics and engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He told AFP he agrees with SpaceX that the test was more a success than a failure. He said the reason the company has made such great progress in recent years is because they are willing to take risks and break things. Devecq added, but they learn from it and improve very, very quickly. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to discuss this week's science report. Thanks for being here today, Brian.
Sure, Ashley. Glad to be back.
In your report, you described damages caused by last week's test of a SpaceX rocket and space capsule. And you noted the company did not expect the level of damage that happened during the rocket's launch. Why was this the case?
So that is a very good question that many people have been asking. There were tests carried out before the final launch, and those should have given engineers some idea what might happen. But Elon Musk has said the main non-launch fire test only ran the rocket's 30 engines at half power. So there's no way this could have predicted the damage that might happen with engines at full power.
In the story, we learned that the Federal Aviation Administration is now investigating the explosion and examining the launch structure. How is this likely to affect future tests of Starship?
Several industry experts have expressed opinions that another test will likely not take place anytime soon because of the government investigation. I should also note, though, that Elon Musk has said the company plans to carry out another test of the rocket within 1 to 2 months. But FAA officials have said they will not approve another test until they are satisfied that the launch structure will hold up and not present any threat to public safety.
Okay, well, thanks again, Brian, for joining me to talk more about this week's report.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In December 1941, the United States was at war. It declared war against Japan after Japanese pilots attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. A few days later, Germany and Italy declared war against the United States. President Franklin Roosevelt quickly decided that America could not fight major campaigns in the Pacific and in Europe at the same time. He and his advisors decided to fight first against the Germans and Italians. Then, when victory in Europe seemed sure, the United States could turn to fight the Japanese in Asia. This left the Japanese free to extend their power throughout Asia and the Western Pacific. Soon after the attack at Hawaii, Japanese forces invaded Hong Kong, Malaya, and the Philippines. American forces in the Philippines suffered heavy losses, and Manila fell to Japanese troops. In February 1942, Japan's forces won a great victory against the British in Singapore. Japanese forces marched into Burma. They attacked Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, and captured the Andaman Islands in the Bay of Bengal. The Japanese military forces seemed too strong to stop. President Roosevelt sent some forces to the Pacific, and he began to rebuild the American naval forces destroyed at Pearl Harbor. But he sent most of America's military strength to Europe. The United States rushed troops and war equipment to help Britain survive against Adolf Hitler's Germany. American military leaders wanted to fight Germany quickly by launching an attack across the English Channel. But British Prime Minister Winston Churchill opposed this. He and others feared such an invasion might fail. So British and American forces attacked Italian and German occupation troops in North Africa. They defeated them and then crossed the Mediterranean Sea to attack enemy forces in Sicily. Within weeks, they pushed the Germans out of Sicily to the Italian mainland. The Allied invasion of Italy followed. Hitler could not strengthen his forces in North Africa and Italy because Germany also was fighting hard in the Soviet Union. Hitler's decision early in the war to attack the Soviet Union was a serious mistake. It divided his men and materials. His plan was to defeat Soviet forces quickly with one strong attack. But he failed, and his failure cost him valuable troops and supplies that might have helped him win the battles for North Africa and Italy. Germany's attack on the Soviet Union began with great success. In the middle of 1941, a German force of more than 3 million men invaded the Soviet Union. It captured the Ukraine, took control of Kiev, and marched deep into Russia. The situation changed the following year. Soviet forces under Marshal Georgi Zhukov won a fierce battle for the city of Stalingrad, now Volgograd. A great many German soldiers died from cold and hunger during the bitter winter months that followed. Zhukov's forces attacked the German troops and pushed back the invaders. Other Soviet troops forced the Germans away from the city of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. By the middle of 1944, German forces throughout the Soviet Union were retreating, and Soviet forces were preparing to push them over the border and invade Germany themselves. The fighting came at a terrible cost. Huge numbers of soldiers and civilians were killed. The fighting in World War II was not limited to land. Battles were also being fought on the sea. The main goal of the German Navy during the war was to prevent the United States from sending ships to Britain with war materials, food, and troops. At first, the Germans were very successful. There was hunger in Britain in 1941 because so few ships could cross the North Atlantic with food. German submarines were the greatest danger to ships crossing the Atlantic. These U-boats, as the Germans called them, could hide below the surface and attack without warning. The threat from German submarines did not ease until new technology was developed in 1943. Allied scientists improved sonar and radar systems that helped find submarines on the surface and underwater. More of the enemy submarines were found and destroyed. The Allies slowly gained control of the Atlantic. Allied and German warships fought a number of traditional naval battles, but airplanes came to play an increasingly important part in the fighting at sea. British ships, with the help of planes launched from an aircraft carrier, destroyed a powerful German battleship, the Bismarck, on May 27, 1941. The most famous air battle of the war in Europe took place during the summer and autumn of the previous year. It was known as the Battle of Britain. It got its name from a speech to Parliament by Prime Minister Churchill following the evacuation of British and French forces from Dunkirk.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. In the House of Commons this afternoon, the Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill, said, "What General Vagar called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin."
It was the most extensive aerial bombing yet in the war. It was also the first battle to be fought entirely in the air. German Stuka dive bombers attacked shipping centers, areas of political importance, airfields, and airplane factories. Luftwaffe pilots in their Messerschmitts battled the Hurricanes and Spitfires of the Royal Air Force. While the flying skills of the German and British pilots were well matched, it was ultimately the greater maneuverability of the British Spitfire that won the long months of battle over the English Channel. The British victory in the air helped prevent Operation Sea Lion, a planned German invasion of Britain. In May of 1942, Britain's Royal Air Force carried out an attack on Germany with 1,000 bombers. It was just the first of many bombing runs over Germany and German-occupied areas by the air forces of Britain and the United States. The planes bombed German military and industrial centers. They also bombed civilian targets in an effort to demonstrate to the German people the price of Germany's aggression. The German cities of Cologne, Dresden, and Hamburg suffered widespread destruction. The Allied bombing attacks continued until the war's end in 1945. Hitler's victories in the early months of the war had struck fear into the hearts of people throughout the world. Hitler and his Axis allies had won battle after battle. They had captured most of Western Europe and invaded the Soviet Union. They had seized North Africa, and their submarines controlled the Atlantic. Germany continued to seem strong during the first months after the United States entered the war in Europe. But the situation began to change. German strength and control were greatest in November of 1942. After then, the mighty German military machine began to slow down. Germany and its Axis partner, Italy, suffered serious losses in the first 6 months of 1943. German losses were extremely heavy in the Soviet Union. 160,000 German troops died at Stalingrad, and more than 110,000 surrendered. American and British forces captured 250,000 German and Italian troops in North Africa. Many more thousands were killed or captured in Sicily and the Italian mainland. German submarines were being destroyed in the North Atlantic, allowing more Allied troops and supplies to reach Britain. By the end of 1943, Hitler and his armies no longer seemed so strong. But German forces continued to occupy France, Belgium, and much of the rest of Western Europe. Now the time had come for the Allies to invade German-held Europe from Britain. Allied forces planned the greatest military invasion in history to break the German control of Europe and win the war.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm